So anyway, welcome today to the Post-Retirement Solutions session. My name's Catherine Nance. We've got three great speakers who are going to look at this issue from three different angles. So Michael Blane, I'm going to introduce you to them formally in a minute, but Michael Blane is going to focus on how best to manage investments into retirement. Dr. David Knox will focus on managing longevity, and Melinda House will be looking at the issues from the consumer side. So because I will introduce the speakers formally, but because many of you know these three people so well from, well, you know their work personalities so well, I thought it'd be useful if they each said something personal about themselves. I've not told them the questions I'm going to ask them, so I'm expecting that they're all just getting really nervous right at the moment. So, Michael, we're starting with you because I'm doing it in the order in which you're speaking. So, Michael's head of investment. So I'm doing the formal bit first. Okay, so Michael's head of investment strategy at First State Super, one of Australia's largest super funds. Prior to joining First State, Michael was head of diversified strategies at Perpetual, where he managed Perpetual's range of diversified funds and established the Perpetual Diversified Real Return Fund. Prior to that, he was a senior member of the investment strategy team at Watson White, where he advised many of the largest and sophisticated institutional investors in Australia on asset allocation. Michael's a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Laws. Oh, you're from the University of Queensland. So am I. Yeah. And is a fellow... I'll go easier on you with the question now, Michael. Yeah. And is a fellow of the Actuaries Institute. So, Michael, tell me something that you are passionate about doing outside of work.
Well, I think spending time with my family, yelling at the kids to do their homework. I think I get quite passionate about that. And,
okay. Yeah. Well, they're not really a thing, but I'll let you get away with that. Yeah. Okay. So, Dr. David Knox, so Senior Partner of Mercer's and Senior Actuary for Australia. So, National Leader of Research, Actuary to the Tasmanian West Australian Public Sector Schemes, author of the Melbourne Mercer Global Pensions Index. And before joining Mercer, David was at PricewaterhouseCoopers and before that, Foundation Professor of Actuarial Studies at the University of Melbourne. So 2 decades of academia, he acted as a consultant to a range of organisations. He's spoken and written widely in this area and has served on many government industry committees. David was an independent member of APRA for a number of years and also president of the Actuaries Institute in 2000. So David, tell me some place you're passionate about outside of work.
Some place?
Place.
Well, I can say that we've just purchased our family holiday home for my 2 sisters down on Western Port Bay. That's happened in the last month, down on Somers, which is an hour's drive from Melbourne. Beautiful little village. Don't go there, please. We want to keep it nice and quiet.
Melinda. Melinda House, General Manager of Superannuation for BT. So Melinda is on the Super FSC Board and Executive Director on the BT Financial Group RSC Board and also on the Advisory Board of Macquarie University's Faculty of Business and Economics. Melinda is an actuary who's worked in financial services for many years. Until June, Director of Product Strategy and Services for AMP. Melinda was many... I think probably all of you know Melinda as CEO of the Actuaries Institute for 3.5 years and prior to that, Director of Policy at ASFA. Previously spent 11 years at BT, so you've sort of gone round the whole bend here. And I actually remember Melinda turning up for, I think, a council meeting at the Institute of Actuaries way back when you were with BT the first time round. And you had a really neat little red briefcase and red shoes and I thought, not the normal actuary. Melinda, tell me someone that you're passionate about outside of work.
Oh. How do I answer this one? Outside of work, okay. It would have to be my 2 children, right. My 13-year-old son and 9-year-old daughter, who I also yell at about their homework.
Right, okay. All right, so we're going to do 10 minutes each in that order, and then we're going to open to questions. So please identify yourselves as you ask a question, and we should have about 20 minutes of question time at the end. So over to you, Michael.
Ed, good afternoon, everyone. So this afternoon I'm talking about the investment side of things, so a topic close to my heart, real return investing to generate retirement income. I guess at the outset I'd say, and I think this is very consistent with some of the themes in this room this morning, is that there's no one size fits all solution, and indeed we're approaching it in our panel today, we're approaching it from different perspectives. There's a whole range of risks that need to be managed, including longevity risk, sequency risk, inflation risk, and having adequate savings. And of course, in many cases, products which solve for one create a problem with the other, and vice versa. And of course, it's a very complex problem where we need to incorporate a whole range of things, including constantly changing tax and social security laws, and as well as the circumstances of each individual. But broadly, and I guess to my part of the discussion, is if you like, an important component of any retirement income solution is going to be a return-seeking portfolio, because ultimately, investors in retirement need a few things. They need to earn a positive and relatively high return net of inflation. At the same time, there's also a need to have a fairly smooth path for those returns, if you like, a sleep at night and comfort factor. And then, of course, you know, you say, well, then we need to manage longevity risk with higher returns. But we also have, of course, sequencing risk, whereby, you know, large negative returns early on when somebody's in the drawdown phase can have a very profound effect on their ability to have income through retirement. And so the solution, aside from generating relatively high CPI plus returns, also needs low volatility, just to make things challenging. I thought one of the interesting things, I think, where the industry's gone is towards life cycle defaults. Look, I think some of them are better designed than others. It'd be fair to say a common criticism of them is that they tend to de-risk people a little bit too early and a little bit too much. So just as a very crude exercise, I just ran a couple of return scenarios, made a ton of assumptions, which are in the appendix, along with some legal disclaimers, and essentially looked at, well, if you earned, you know, relatively high returns, CPI plus 6, which would be pretty aggressive, that would be pretty much what you should expect from 100% equity strategy over the long term, and earned that to age 55, and then de-risked thereafter and earned about CPI plus 3. So a very simple life cycle strategy with just two breaks, and then you sit on that all the way through retirement. You know, how many years would your money last under this sort of, if you like, constant rate of return assumption? And there it was about 17. Now, then what I thought I'd do is just, not that I'm suggesting that this is something that people should do, adopt a relatively more conservative strategy early on when you're younger, and then move to a more aggressive strategy when you're older. This would be, if you like, the anti-life cycle approach. And under the anti-life cycle approach, your expected outcome is, of course, that your money actually lasts longer in retirement. Now, of course, you're going to have a lot of uncomfortable volatility, and there's a whole lot of flaws with that, but the point is more just that aggressive de-risking near retirement is not necessarily the answer. I've then, just for comparison, I've put what you'd get if you got CPI plus 5 throughout, which is a slightly higher average rate of return than the other two, and so not surprisingly, your money lasts a bit longer. And then I've sort of tried to show that graphically, just by saying, well, again, if what you did was just summed up your total investment earnings, cradle to grave, in a, if you like, a accumulation phase plus a drawdown in pension phase, where do you actually earn most of your, if you like, total aggregate career investment earnings? And you actually earn 3/4 of your aggregate earnings for your whole life between ages 55 and 80. Now, of course, there are emotional reasons why people want to de-risk at those latter stages, and we all saw that with people deferring retirement with the GFC and whatnot. But I think that does give us pause for thought around whether large de-risking is actually sensible, because ultimately you need to earn most of the returns when you've got the largest balance. Now, I thought I'd throw in a couple of inconvenient and depressing slides. They're, you know, always quite helpful. The first one was just the Aussie 5-year government bond yield, and I also overlaid that with inflation. Now, one of the wonderful things going back 20 years ago was that on very low-risk government bonds, you could actually get a return that exceeded inflation by a very good margin. That made life easier. And, you know, as if you like, a professional asset allocator, for all my sins, that did make my life a lot easier back then. These days, of course, the real return that you should expect on bonds looking forward is basically zero or negative. And indeed, in some parts of the world, we've violated the economic theory by having negative yields. Fortunately, we're not quite there yet in this market. So that's another reason, if you like, not to de-risk too heavily coming into retirement. The other slightly inconvenient thing is the flip side of that, which is equity markets. Now, what I've done on this chart is basically taken the S&P 500 because you can get the most data for the US equities have the longest, clean data sets. And then I've looked at, essentially, I've inverted the price to earnings ratio. So said, well, what's the earnings yield on the market, if you like. How much earnings does, if you like, $100 of capital invested buy you? So that's I think it's a blue line. I'm a little bit colorblind, but the blue line running across there, and then you've got the subsequent 10-year return that was realized for investors. There is obviously not a perfect relationship, but there is actually quite a strong relationship between the price you pay for an asset and the returns you get subsequently. And funny enough, most of that is actually explained by changes in sentiment, not by changes in earnings. Earnings are actually, whilst there's variability from year to year, they are remarkably stable over 10-year periods, which is what this looks at. The vast bulk of that volatility simply comes from how much investors are willing to pay for those future earnings. And unfortunately, we have been through a couple of decades of elevated price-to-earnings ratios, but if we look back through the sort of prior 100 years, we're at one of the most expensive points for US equities in history. Now, the one thing I would say is Aussie equities don't look as bad as that. However, you've got to be comfortable with a market that's almost 50% financials, which is the rub. So traditional set and forget asset allocation is not necessarily entirely appropriate in retirement. And, you know, a more dynamic approach is needed to solve these dual problems of needing to both find high returns, but at the same time have much lower drawdown risk than what you'd get from, say, a 100% equity strategy. And in order to do that, kind of need to think about, well, how can I find return in the world today where assets are pumped up, we've got quantitative easing, we've got financial repression, we've got all those wonderful buzzwords. Well, I think one way is to say, well, try and find the best value assets that you can across markets. And that might require some slightly unconventional thinking. It might require doing things like holding global equities but not holding any US equities at all. It might do things like pushing into emerging markets, which are which have been somewhat bashed up and are somewhat on the nose, which is usually a very good sign for future returns, and doing things like taking your Aussie equities and tilting it away from the concentration in banks. Obviously, those things are good for return. You also need to manage risks and manage things like inflation risk, which is something which a lot of strategies don't manage particularly well. And holding things like inflation-linked bonds and commodities can be a good solution for that, so can some real assets. Also finding cheap ways to protect a portfolio. Options are generally an expensive way to protect a portfolio, but there are things that you can buy from time to time that will help you protect. And, of course, what's appropriate is time varying depending on market pricing. And then, I guess, finally, the boring old cash. Cash has an option value if you're disciplined and if you're willing to put money to work when everyone else is feeling scared and depressed, then cash can be quite additive to returns. And whilst the current yield on that is very low, having a reasonable proportion in cash at this point is actually quite a reasonable thing to do for a return-seeking investor if you've got the valuation discipline and processes in place to put that money to work when valuations improve. Because one thing whilst future returns are uncertain, one thing we should count on is having bouts of volatility at some point in the future. So I guess that's it for me. That's the start to the inconvenient problem of an account-based pension where we need to earn actually quite high returns to get a decent standard of living but try to get low volatility as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. And my slides will pop up. There we go. Longevity pooling. There's been quite a few papers this summer on longevity pooling, GSAs, etc. So I'm going to take you through some of those issues and then go through very briefly our product that is on the marketplace. But before I do that, well, making sure I press the right button. There we go. This is not personal financial advice. So do not apply what I say to yourself unless you think it's appropriate. Okay, so what is, in very broad terms, a longevity pooling product? Simply, members put money into a pool. Regular payments are made from that pool to survivors. In other words, if you die or exit early, you give up some of your money. That covers idiosyncratic longevity risk. In other words, we're in it together. And those who live longer get more out of it. Those who die earlier give up something. It doesn't cover systemic risk. You can make various assumptions about that. But if we're all going to live to 150, we're not going to have enough money. I don't think mortality rates are going to suddenly halve. They will continue to decline. But putting it out there, these products only cover idiosyncratic longevity risk. There are no guaranteed payments. But on the other hand, no guaranteed income. On the other hand, there's no capital payments, no capital requirements. So there's no shareholder requiring capital servicing or dividends. So generally speaking, the members normally will receive a better return than from an annuity. Similarly, with no guarantee, the investment experience is borne by the individual. So what are some of the issues when you want to design these products? Firstly, how much should you put into your longevity product? We don't think you should put your whole lump sum into a longevity pooling product. We think the appropriate percentage is somewhere between 20 and 35%, depending on the individual. Again, this pool of capital is going to have investment earnings. What do you do with those earnings? Do you distribute them, or do they stay in the pool to be paid to the survivors? You're going to have some mortality credits. We actuaries understand that. Let me assure you that's not a very good marketing term when you want to take a product out to the retirees. Mortality credits don't sell, but you know what I mean. Who should get them? How are they distributed? And what happens on death? Is there a withdrawal benefit if someone wants to pull their money out before they die? Suddenly diagnosed with cancer, terminal illness, what happens? It's a question you need to consider. Similarly, where do you invest the money? Is it a conservative investment? Is it a balanced investment? Is it a high growth investment? And do you think about pools or cohorts of members? Do you bring them all together into one open pool, or do you have separate cohorts for separate years? Longevity pooling, whether it's a pure GSA or a GSA type product, needs to consider these sorts of issues. So what are some of the benefits to retirees? The biggest concern retirees have is that their money will run out. If you're in a longevity pool, the money will not run out. It's not guaranteed at a particular level, but it will not run out. You will not just be on the age pension. As I've said, it's a mutual pool, so there's no shareholders. The expected benefits are higher than if you purchased an annuity. One of the advantages from a super fund is that the super fund can offer it as an investment option within the account-based pension. So there's no third-party direct involvement. The retiree is dealing directly with the super fund. And depending on how you design it, the retiree may well have access to the retiree's capital or to their capital. They may be able to draw it down, depending on the design. So you need to think of this as part of the investment portfolio. It's not necessarily a de-risking, depending on how it's invested in the longevity pool, how it's invested in the balance of the account-based pension. So there are lots of benefits to retirees, but they don't come risk-free. So what are some of the risks? Well, you're not quite sure what the income is going to be from this longevity pool. It's a little bit uncertain. It will depend on the experience. But Australians, retirees, have lived with that, with their account-based pension. We're used to dealing with uncertain income, and many funds are now using a bucket approach where there is a cash bucket and there are other buckets. So you draw down on the cash to try and steady out that income. What if I die early? Do I lose my money? Well, that depends on the design of the product, like it is with an annuity product. What's paid back if you die early or exit early? What if nobody dies? There is no mortality credits. That's true. But as an actuary, as you all know, we will eventually die. I can't say when, I can't say who, but death is part of life, if that's not an oxymoron. And what about counterparty risk? What about the provider of this longevity pool? Is there a counterparty risk? Not really. If you design it as a standalone unit trust, for instance, with appropriate trustees, it's separate from any provider, it's separate from the super fund, it's just an investment product. So let's have a look at what I can say is the only product of this type available. It just happens to be one that Mercer offers, Mercer Lifetime Plus. Very brief description. We've gone for a conservative investment option. Why have we done that? Because we want people who are worried about longevity to have some confidence that their money won't run out. It's part of their overall investment strategy. We pay the investment earnings out every quarter. It's not retained by the pool, so it helps pay the pension. We don't call it mortality credits. It's called a living bonus. That's a little bit sexier and more attractive. That's paid every half year, so there is no reserving. In a pure GSA, there are reserves. In this product, everything is paid out. All that's retained is the capital. What's more, we start to pay the capital back after 15 years. And on exit before age 75, you get most of your money back, 95%. That withdrawal benefit gradually reduces as you stay in the product. But that removes the major problem where people are worried about losing money. If you think about it, most 65, 70-year-olds who buy a longevity product are in pretty good health. So we're not expecting many of them to die early. So what does it look like in terms of cash flow? Firstly, and these are in today's dollars, we're going to pay the investment earnings back to help pay the pension every year. So you start at a certain level, you've got the same amount of capital, so in real terms that gradually reduces, and after 15 years you pay some of the capital back anyway, so the investment earnings do reduce. But of course this might only be a quarter or a third of your whole account-based pension. You've got a lot of other earnings from elsewhere. We're going to start paying capital back after 15 years, and by the time you get to age 99, you've actually got half your capital back. One of the reasons we do that is to stop the exponential spread of the living bonus, because if you base the living bonus on mortality rates, or QX, they rise pretty steeply, and they almost look like an exponential curve. By paying some of the capital back, that dampens that, but it also gives money for people to live on in their older years. And there's the living bonus. The living bonus is material and significant at the older ages, which in my view is exactly where it should be for longevity protection. You're not after longevity protection at the age of 70 or 80, because you've got other capital, you've got other investments you're living on. It's the problem of running out of money at 85, 90 or whatever that this is designed to remove. So just finally, what about the distribution of outcomes? What we've done here is we looked at a case study of someone who retires with $450,000. They want a fairly modest income of $32,000, about $10,000 above the single age pension. And what's the probability of them meeting that income? Well, 2 years after they retire, we've got three options here. One is the average default in the dark blue. The aqua colour is with some tailoring with the investments, a little bit of de-risking and derivatives there to minimise some volatility. And the pale blue is with 25% of Lifetime Plus. And you can see that up to about age 88, it doesn't make much difference. But it's in those latter years when you're worried about longevity that it makes the big difference and increases significantly the probability that people won't run out of money. With 14 seconds left on the clock, I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the customer perspective. I've been working in superannuation for close to a quarter of a century now. When I started out quite young and idealistic, I was pretty convinced that we could educate and engage the Australian population on their super, that people had taken interest and it would be all good. Now I'm older, wiser and possibly a lot more jaded on that front. I think we're still struggling to interest a disengaged population who see superannuation as a tax, something that's taken out of their salary. So with that context in mind, and having heard from Michael and David about some of the innovative new products and services out there, and we've heard a lot of thinking on that over the last 2 days, how do we position these for our members and customers so that they get the best possible advantage? Well, at BT we spend a lot of time thinking about this. Our mission is actually helping people prepare for their best financial future forever. So that's a pretty important task. So how in the context of post-retirement can we do that? The take-up of post-retirement products offering longevity insurance has proven problematic. A number of new variable annuity-style products have been launched in recent years and that haven't got traction. And older-style lifetime annuities have been withdrawn from sale, although we are starting to see a bit of a revival of that more recently. As Steve Nagel said in the session on just before lunch, retirees' needs can be better met using products combinations, including annuities. If the benefits can be effectively communicated, more annuities will be purchased. So that's the if I'm really going to be talking about. And it is a big if, because unfortunately, customers perceive risk differently to the way actuaries do. Behavioural economics tells us that due to heuristics and framing, and I've got definitions of those up there, you're probably familiar with them already, people don't always make rational decisions about their finances. This is the case with super, and it's particularly the case with post-retirement. Yesterday, Anton Capel's sessions on retirement income solutions talked about three behavioural biases. He talked about overconfidence and optimism, hyperbolic discounting and loss aversion. Now, there was an interesting paper in the most recent Australian Journal of Actuarial Practice, AJAP, which is out there on the stand. If you haven't looked at that, there's some great post-retirement papers in there. And this paper was by Talitha O'Meara, Akanksha Sharma and Aaron Brun, and it was called Australia's Piece of the Puzzle, Why Don't Australians Buy Annuities? And they had a very interesting look at reasons, rational reasons why people don't buy annuities, but then a whole bunch of irrational reasons why we don't buy annuities. And expected rational annuity behaviour is very different to behaviour retirees and pre-retirees actually exhibit. So I won't go through the rational reasons, but I just thought I'd show you a snapshot, and it's very small, I know, of a whole bunch of the irrational reasons, and I'm not going to go through all of those. I'd encourage you to have a look at the paper. But I just thought I'd pull out a couple of examples of irrational decisions customers make based on their behavioural biases. When we're young, we don't think we'll ever die, and so we avoid thinking about unpleasant events like death. But then, quite paradoxically, when we're near retirement and we do think about dying, we think we'll die at the same age as our parents died. Or our grandparents died. So we significantly underestimate our life expectancy, so we underprepare for how much money we might need. And so some of those things are outlined there at the bottom of the table. Another example on the second line is the longevity gamble, where people view annuities as a gamble based on their time of death. So it's quite different thinking about an annuity. Do I give my money to the insurer or the super fund? You know, if I die young, I've been ripped off. If I live longer, I'll get a good payoff from it. It's very different to the way people think about general insurance, like their home and contents, for example, which is equally a gamble based on whether the hailstorm will hit your house that year, which it just did my place, actually, in Haberfield. So there are some other examples as well in the paper, and these are have been pulled from a number of research. So there's one there, for example, peer influence, or otherwise known as taxi driver tips, where you talk to other people and you do what they're doing. So there's all these different sorts of ways people make decisions around their post-retirement. But the paper in the conclusion says there are several reasons for the apparent puzzle that the demand for annuities in voluntary markets falls significantly short of what might be expected in a rational market. And I'll just read them out. These include the provision of an age pension, which provides some mitigation against longevity, investment, inflation and counterparty risks. The nature of Australia's superannuation system, which predominantly focuses on the attainment of savings rather than the provision of retirement incomes. A lack of incentives for retirees to annuitise. The perception that the annuity's value is low, hence it appears expensive, especially in a low interest rate environment. Issues around marketing and distribution, so for example, having to give up a big lump sum versus maybe paying for an annuity over time with smaller premiums might be more palatable. And lastly, there's societal trends towards greater individualisation and self-sufficiency, which may work against some of the pooling concepts we've been talking about. So, super and retirement is a challenging field in which to develop offers for customers, because of the behavioural biases, as I've outlined, but we've also got a very disengaged customer base, which I talked about at the start, who view super, as I said, as a tax. And if you talk to people, it's really interesting. We ring our customers who've opened a super account but haven't funded it or haven't put their rollovers in, and they're always going to get round to it. Yeah, I know that's really important, but it's kind of way below in terms of fun ways to spend your weekend. It's way below doing your tax return in terms of sexiness of appeal. Yeah, I'll go and sort my super out this weekend. Yes, fired up to do that. So that's the way most of us are. And then at 45 or 50, we have that oh shit moment where we suddenly realise, hang on, I'm going to be retiring in 15 years. I better do something about my super. So then we turn from disengagement to panic, apprehension. I don't have enough. What do I do? Where do I get information? It's confusing, it's complex. So thinking then about what customers want when they get to the point of being engaged, they want to know, do I have a cost-effective solution? They want information from someone they can trust. And there, as we heard this morning, there are trust issues with the industry at the moment across a broad range of financial services. And they want information, guidance, and maybe advice as well. But I think the way we've thought in the past about what customers want has been very much focused on advice. It was an interesting session from Stephen Huppert yesterday on disruption, and he talked a little bit about robo-advice and provision of sort of more information and guidance as opposed to advice. I think that's going to be on the upswing. There's been some research by Investment Trends on what customers actually prefer in retirement, and this is quite complex. So on the right-hand side, what it shows is that these are the reasons people seek advice, and the biggest reason, as you can see there, is actually for retirement planning. So that is still true. Yes, when we get to retirement, we do want some advice, but what do we actually want? And this is what the left-hand side is showing. Each of those bars is a different age group from starting out through to retirees. And it's showing that not all of the demand at retirement or even pre-retirement, which are the right-hand two bars, are for comprehensive advice. That's only the bit at the very top of those bars. And interestingly, the very bottom segment of that bar is general advice and DIY. So really that's just information, and people like you do this sort of thing. That's what general advice is. So what I found really interesting about this research was that 31% of pre-retirees and 42% of retirees only want general advice. They don't necessarily want to sit down and do a full comprehensive financial plan. And this is where some of these more automated tools and web calculators and a lot of the things we've been seeing over the last couple of days are really going to come to the fore and meet a lot of needs. So there's a variety of ways to access information: face-to-face, robo-planning, self-directed diagnostics, online help, and a lot of super funds are then supporting that by telephone information and advice. So I guess when we look at what the customers want, what we have, which is actually a very complex set of products and interrelated solutions to provide that, not all of which are currently allowed by legislation, but let's assume that that one gets solved. I guess if we look at then where to from here in terms of trends, the answer is clear from the discussions we've been having over the last couple of days. The answer won't be a single product. It's going to be a mix or blend of products. People who get advice will have an advisor able to put those together for them. I think increasingly we'll see packages of products being provided on a continuum of offers and services. So I think there's two big trends I see. One is that we've always thought about superannuation and retirement offers as products. I think we're going to be moving away from that, and what we'll see is single products or continuums of products where you can switch services on and off as people go through their lifetime, and actually even into retirement you just might be switching a different feature of your super fund on to create your retirement option, and then you can dip in and out of that as you dip in and out of the workforce. So that's very much how we're thinking about product development in the way we're setting up our new platforms, which we're working on right now. The second is that although in the background, it's like the duck, although in the background we're churning away, there's incredible complexity of the products and offers behind it, there's actuarial models all over the place, massive jobs for the boys and girls, happy days. To the customer, it has to be like the duck sliding along the surface. It has to be seamless. It has to appear easy. And that's the bit I don't think we've really nailed yet as an industry, and I think that's our real challenge. How do we create a thing, you know, like the nice little calculator Nicolette was showing before, an app, a few slidey bars, you know, move this back and forward, see what the result is over here. Behind the scenes, we're creating a suite of products or services that delivers that, but for the customer, it's actually easy and simple. So that's our challenge, and I think we're a long way still from that at the moment, but there's good direction on that. So as the last speaker, Kathy asked me to pose some questions, I guess, to get the discussion going. So I guess three things that you think about when you've heard a lot of the presentations we've been having and heard from Michael on investments and David on the new product that Mercer have developed. And the questions, the counterparty risk one is one that's always trotted out in these discussions, so I thought I'd throw that one out there again, of will the provider that you've got in the pool with or given your annuity money to be around in the 30 years' time when you need to be collecting the last of your income. The second one is the tension or conflict between an investment strategies type approach and a longevity pooling type approach. And the last one is from the customer's perspective, with an insured versus a pooled annuity where there is a guarantee versus there isn't a guarantee, the challenge of how do we, and David's talked through some of these things in his presentation, how do we really explain that to the customers so they understand what they've got is a projection but not a guarantee of income, and things are really going to change year to year based on the experience of the pool. So I thought that might be a good place to kick off questions with Kathy. Thank you.
Everyone, so it's time for questions. We've got about 10, 15 minutes. Whilst you're thinking and getting organised, I might start with a couple. So, David, the first one to you is, with these sort of like longevity type pools, do you believe at some stage that they may need to be regulated, almost like a MySuper? Because if they got very popular, a lot of people could sort of get into them, and then you've got to say, well, you've got like a management risk associated with them. What's your views?
Okay. I'd like to broaden the question a little bit to SIPPs, which is the comprehensive income product that was mentioned in the FSI report. I think those products or those SIPPs, which I would advocate, should be developed, and the government should press on with that. Whilst they may not need to be approved, like my SIPPs were approved like APRA, I think APRA should have oversight of them. So if a fund was to develop more than one SIPP, let's say three SIPPs for different balances, then I think the trustees need to put those up to APRA so that APRA, not necessarily in the approval process, but has oversight of them. And I think it's feasible that longevity products, whether they're a pooled product or an annuity, in some cases will be part of those SIPPs. So APRA will look through and see it from that perspective.
Okay. And one question both to you, Michael, and to you, Melinda, is that You know, both of you talked about, like from Michael's point of view, a fairly sort of sophisticated investment portfolio where you might even be taking quite active decisions, US equities, emerging markets. And Melinda talks about the fact that you might have a whole host of product, the mix of which might change over time. So the obvious question is that that implies a fairly high level of personal advice, because to get that type of asset allocation, to get that type of product allocation, so how do you perceive retirees in the future are going to be paying for this? Because that sort of falls outside general robo-type advice, I would have thought. But anyway, what's your view?
Well, I guess I'd start off. I actually think the industry movement towards sector specialist products in mixes that retirees have is actually a big backward step. I actually think we kind of lost something when we moved away from pre-mixed multi-asset class products, because the amount of, I guess there's a couple of things. If you want to be genuinely active in asset allocation, then an individual with a financial advisor can't really do that. So it needs to be prepackaged in some form. And I think the other thing is, to be successful in active asset allocation over a long time period requires a huge amount of discipline. It requires contrarian thinking. It actually requires doing things which would be extremely uncomfortable for an individual to do. So I think the only way to deal with that is to actually have better objective-based prepackaged products where the product, if you like, the product pitch to the consumer is quite simple. It's that, you know, we'll use a wide range of asset classes, including property, equities, fixed income. We'll manage that quite actively over time, and we will aim to deliver you the return that, you know, it's for this particular product, you know, we're targeting a CPI plus 5, let's say, over rolling 5-year periods. So I think, you know, again, you can have a lot of the ducks under the water. You can have a lot of complexity in the actual product, but then a lot of it just comes down to how that is then described and sold to the end user. But I think I see these, if you like, model portfolios, if you like, in retail land, where you see a plethora of products that an individual is supposed to have, and it may have a nice feeling of sophistication, and maybe it helps with some of those behavioural things when you're buying a financial plan, that you feel like you're getting more value for money. But I think the reality is a better outcome for the consumer would actually be a smaller number of things that they own, where the complexity is managed by somebody else.
Yeah, I sort of see. I mean, if you think about, I think what we're seeing is the democratisation of financial advice, really. So things like life stages, whether you agree or not with the philosophy behind them, that's an example of what you were talking about, where actually it's all packaged in the product and you pay more for that than you would a straight balance fund. But actually that's an example of someone else takes care of that complexity for you and you're accessing expertise. I think we'll see that extended out as well to mix of products. So if the CIPRA, is it, gets up, we'll see the trustees' pick being actually this is the mix of products and we just adjust it for you over time. And, you know, if you want to opt out of that and start doing your slidey bars and electing things, that's all fine. But if you don't, here's what the trustees set for you. And it'll probably cost a little bit of a premium to get into that, but that's how they'll pay for it. It'll be standard defaults increasingly that do that. Mm. Or if you want to start to tailor it yourself, you might have a bit of a DIY. If you want to access some help, you might pay a little more for that. If you want to, obviously, if you're accessing full advice, you pay for that now. Mm. But there'll be a continuum from information all the way through to full advice, and the costs of all of that will be coming down over time, I think. Mm. Mm.
Thanks. Just please identify yourself.
Tony Boffinger from Challenger. So very interested in annuities for the purposes of full disclosure. And so therefore there's all sorts of things I could say, but I will try to limit what I say. First of all, I guess to the question of the tension between GSAs which don't have guarantees versus annuities which do. I think that is a big challenge. I think that one thing we need to do is be careful with our language. So, you know, not use words like insurance to describe GSAs because they're not insurance. And also people need to work out how to communicate the uncertainty. And, you know, I hasten to add this is not, this particular comment is not such a big deal for the Mercer product, but if you have a traditional GSA where you get a payment which sort of gives you an ex-ante mortality credit, which may or may not play out, then you can get into this sort of fight to the bottom of people who take more and more aggressive mortality assumptions to start off saying, well, you know, this guy's saying that 5,000, I'll give you 5.5. And if you're wrong, the customer wears it, you don't. So if that sort of thing goes on, then there's a scandal brewing around that. So that's just a few general comments. My other comment, I must take issue, sorry, David, with one of the things you said about GSAs not having any shareholder costs or whatever. I also find it a little bit concerning that we somehow think life company shareholders making money for delivering their capital is more offensive than other people making profits. So there is, you know, there's fees involved in the Mercer product. Mercer makes profits out of it, but somehow is that less offensive than a life company making profits? I don't understand.
Sorry. Thanks, Tony. A couple of comments. Certainly, I'm not anti-annuity, but I think we need to recognise that with annuities there are capital behind it, and I really just was commenting, if you like, from other papers, that in normal expectations there is the difference between a guaranteed product and a non-guaranteed product, and that difference is capital, and that capital has to be serviced. In terms of our product, we are very, very careful not to call it insurance, not to use the word guarantees. In our very early discussions with APRA, they said, are you going to guarantee everything? I said, absolutely not. And we've been very careful not to use the word insurance or guarantees. So we're upfront about that, absolutely. I actually foresee the day where a super fund or a provider could offer members both an annuity and a GSA-type product, and the member chooses where they want to be on the risk-return trade-off, much the same as you do with investments from cash through to equities and growth. So the more products we have out there, the better, because I think we are then serving our retirees better.
Thanks. One more question, Elaine.
Elaine Grace, the Actuaries Institute. I'm just curious to know where you think the market's going to be in 10 years if the government is slow to take up these FSI recommendations. Like, I mean, has the seed been sown, and so that trustees will just kind of get on with it and the market will push ahead?
Good question. It's very hard to predict government. We do know that the government, we're expecting the government to respond to the FSI in mid-year, let's say July, give or take. My view is that the government will press ahead with a number of the FSI recommendations. What that then means in terms of SIPPers, for instance, and how they detail that is, I think, an open question. But I think as an industry, not only the Actuaries Institute, but as for FSC, ISA, we all want retirement incomes. So I think that's the direction we need to move, and we need to speak with a united voice on that one. Our SIPPers, the ideal, I think there'll be debate around various features of SIPPers, but I'd certainly applaud that direction.
Thanks. So I think we'll have to wrap up. So thanks, everyone, for coming. So I'd like to thank Michael and David and Melinda, and we've got a bottle of wine each, and also Henry Zhang from First State, who actually organised the session but couldn't be here today. So thanks, everyone.